I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss the psychology of attachments. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abruzzese are here to shed some light on the topic. Good morning to you both.
Hi, Mindy.
Good morning.
All right, so attachment is an emotional bond to another person. Psychologist John Bowlby was said to be the first attachment theorist, describing attachment as a lasting psychological connectedness between human beings, and he believed the bonds formed in childhood have a tremendous impact that continues throughout life. Everybody agree with that?
Well, that's sure. Pretty true, but he was not the first theorist. The first theorist was Harry Harlow back in the late 50s, who did research when you were permitted to do this kind of research with small monkeys. I believe they were rhesus monkeys. And he had what later we called a love theory, how people develop love bonds, and by having a wire monkey mother. Which, of course, was no mother at all for them. So the little babies tried to have a relationship with this wire mother, and it was no go. Mm. And they, through a series of manipulations in his experimental model, it was very clear that there were what he called three separate types of attachment to a live mother, and he figured this out by using this wire mother. That later developed into Mary Ainsworth's work, which talked a little bit more about kids and codified that a bit more, and that culminated in John Bowlby's work. I think Mary Ainsworth and John Bowlby got married and continued the research together. But started out with Harry Harlow, and that has been a surprisingly robust finding and has been developed. So I think that's very true. The attachment model that John Bowlby developed is most influential.
Yeah,
sure. And it was a departure from psychoanalytic theory at the mm-hmm. time and was met with a lot of storm because it was such a departure. But it's something that has lasted and will probably last much longer than psychoanalytic theory will.
So the need to be in a close relationship embedded in our genes?
Certainly. And it makes sense that it should be, because if you think of the evolution of our brain, which happened over, it's estimated, a period of 2.5 million years ago to up to 10,000 years ago. And then we pretty much have the same brain, actually, as our ancestors roughly 10,000 years ago. But all of the brain evolved at a time and at a place, the African savanna, which was a pretty dangerous place. So that means that the modules of the brain evolved according to what we call natural selection, whatever provided for survival and reproduction in that environment, and danger being one of the big pressures, because it was so easy to become another animal's meal. So that you can understand how it would make sense for people to kind of pair up for someone to watch someone's back. And if someone watched someone's back and would be reliable in doing that and definitely there, those two people would become attached.
Mm.
Furthermore, what seals the promise is the emotion of romantic love, because you can imagine if two people kind of get together in this dangerous environment, they could break the promise very easily if somebody else came along and they could go off with the other person.
Not that that would ever happen in real life.
Right. Yeah, we've evolved out of that, right? With the emotion of romantic love, it makes for a sealing of the promise. Romantic love is something that happens. It's an emotion that develops automatically.
Mm-hmm.
It's not under conscious control, and we can talk more about
that. Yeah, we definitely want to talk more about that.
But it just happens, and knowing that it's there means that the promise of pairing is going to stay intact, and that's what makes it work. Mm-hmm. So that's what that would be selected for. The people that developed the practice, behavior of romantic love are going to survive more, and that's why it's in our genes.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Well, I think we have to differentiate between attraction and attachment. Bowlby's theory about attachment talks about human capacity to form attachments, and we can form attachments with anything.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have possessions that they're very attached to, but they're not that very fond of having attachments towards people. That's because, as Mark was talking about, the biological imperative is hardwired into us to have attachment to an object, because an object in humans being another person to start out with, because otherwise no surviving infant of any animal species would survive. birth is very difficult, and if there wasn't an imperative between mother and offspring to bond together, then no offspring would survive. And certainly we have examples in animal studies. It's just if you were just a veterinarian, you would be able to see that there are some moms, large animals, small animals, that just don't seem very attached to their newborn offspring. But they can be encouraged. Mm. And there are some moms who just cannot be encouraged, and those little offspring have to be put with another, a different sheep or cow or something like that. And we do have, unfortunately, quite a great deal of history with parents or moms who do not want to have anything to do with their own children that are born as humans. The most common discussion takes place around something called postpartum depression, which is a really hopefully temporary difficulty in forming any kind of attachment. But attachment is different from
attraction.
Yeah. And attachment, it's really a good thing that we have attachment. That keeps us having the will to live and the will to go on, even if it might be difficult for us to have attachments to other people. Some folks who have certain dimensions of autistic spectrum have a great amount of difficulty attaching to other people, but they have no difficulty attaching to other things.
Mm-hmm. Objects,
right. Yeah,
yes.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll talk about attraction after. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about attachment, though. These three main types of attachment styles that we find in children and adults, what are they?
First of all, these came out of research with infants, which developed after Bowlby started his work and Ainsworth. I think it was Ainsworth maybe who even developed this particular paradigm. And there's a test that she developed called the Strange Situation Test. And it's been designed to test infants from the age of 12 months to 18 months. Consists of pretty simply an experimenter in the room with a mother and a young child, and they establish some play, some interaction, and then the mother leaves the room, and observers are watching what happens when this happens. Universally, children are upset at this age when the mother leaves the room, but they react to it and behave in different styles as a response. If a secure attachment style, which is one of the first styles, is that the child is upset, but then starts to calm down and gets involved in play. And then when the mother returns, the child is happy, greets the mother, and a connection is established, and then gets back to play and goes on. However, the child could be anxious and have an anxious attachment style. And that's manifested by, as soon as the mother leaves the room, the child gets very upset, throws something of a tantrum, and does not really calm down while the mother is out. And then when the mother comes back, there's an ambivalence. There's a greeting, but there's also an anger, and the child might push the mother away, for instance.
Mad.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely mad because of the punishment he just went through. And then takes longer to calm down after that. Then there's the third style is avoidant. And in that observation, the child doesn't seem to be bothered by the mother leaving the room, just continues playing. And when the mother returns, doesn't make much of an impact, just continues playing. And it's as if he doesn't care. Mm-hmm. However, it's been studied, the child is not in a state of not caring because the autonomic nervous system is quite active when the mother leaves. In other words, the body's under stress with blood pressure, heart rate, and breathing, and it's just not obvious behaviors. So those three styles, anxious, avoidant, and secure, are what determines to a large extent the child's future relationships. Mm-hmm. It's not set in stone, but it influences a lot. And we see those three styles in adults.
So give us some examples of what that would be in an adult. You know, these different secure seems pretty high.
Secure is
most,
wonderful.
Most people fall into secure, right?
Yes, 50% supposedly fall into secure. Secure would be the individuals who are warm and loving. They don't get rattled very much by the behavior of the other individual. They tune into the other individual and respond appropriately to the other individual's needs. An anxious person, however, is someone who spends a lot of time and psychological energy worrying about, thinking about the other person's state of mind, whether they love them enough, whether they're sensitive to them enough, whether they're going to do what they want them to do or hope them to do. They're super sensitive to little changes in mood in the partner, and they take it personally. And they protest a lot as soon as there's a disruption. That would be the anxious mm-hmm. person. Statistically, it's supposedly 20-25% of individuals can be characterized like this. And then the avoidant individual is someone who equates closeness with being controlled mm-hmm. and threat, the threat of being dominated. So they avoid and act as if nothing bothers them. Inside, it does. Mm-hmm. But their overt behavior is as if nothing bothers them. And any invitation to closeness is a stimulus for them to go the other direction. Mm. The commitment phobic might be the
term. We all know people like that. They seem to not want to commit.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just their nature. Mm-hmm. That's how they go through life. Unless they have some experiences, therapeutic or otherwise, that encourage them to try out some different styles.
Well, attachment theory goes really to the heart of what Mark's talking about in human relationships, and it really talks a lot about the individual, not so much the relationship. So a person who's securely attached, they have the normal ups and downs. They're able to make relationships, have friends, have lovers, get married, get divorced, go through the normal human experience with normal ups and downs. The research indicates, the early research certainly indicated that people who are what we classified as anxious attached seem to have the most difficult in life. They have difficulty making stable attachments. It's like maybe a car operating on only a few cylinders, having not enough air in one tire. It's a very unbalanced, awkward kind of dance. They don't seem to be able to negotiate the intricacies of human relationships with any kind of equanimity. So they usually have the worst outcome. You would think the avoidant people would have the most difficult income or up result, but it's really the anxious avoidance, the anxious attached who do. And the avoidance, pretty much, they're kind of self-contained. They can, James Brown used to say, hit it and quit it. They mm-hmm. used to get involved and zip in and zip out, like people mm-hmm. who zip in and zip out of traffic. So they actually have a much, much better kind of life. And mm-hmm. This goes back to the original research. Ainsworth called them type A, B, and C before we get fancy and able to figure out more what it was about. And an example of a disrupted attachment, like an anxious attachment, would be a condition called reactive attachment disorder, which many people who adopt children from foreign countries at a very young age, from I guess mostly it's Eastern Bloc mm-hmm. countries
Bosnia, yeah.
who had much more difficult upbringing because mm-hmm. their idea of raising children in orphanage was different than the folks in the Western culture. Those children take years and sometimes can be violent towards their parents, and parents are totally flummoxed as to what's going on. And sometimes these children get a host of psychological and psychiatric diagnoses, none of which is really getting to the bottom of it, that they have a reactive attachment disorder. And as Mark mentioned, it takes years of good treatment before it starts to change.
But it can change.
It can change, but it takes years of good treatment. And when things get very difficult for these individuals, they tend to revert, as everyone does, they tend to revert to their childhood developmental issues, which means they go back into a reactive attachment disorder mode, and they have to be sort of coaxed out of that again. So that would be an example. People who adopt children and the children are just so off the wall. Well, there was something in the news several years ago where, I guess, parents put a child back on the plane to Russia.
Yeah. Said, oh, yes.
Sent
yeah.
away. I mean, that would suggest to me a reactive attachment disorder.
Right. Yeah, and but also, that didn't help that at all, did it?
Also, very poor clinical care these folks got. I don't know who was in charge of the adoption, what agency they used, but, I mean, certainly they needed to get some help. We have agencies on the Cape who do foreign adoptions, and I know that many of them have a provision for reactive attachment disorder, and some parents are getting more educated about that. So a person with an anxious attachment tends to have a development into a reactive attachment disorder, and that would be an example of something going wrong, mm-hmm. whereas the kind of attachments that most people have is an example of a type A or a affirmative attachment, mm-hmm. and then the people who are kind of pretty much loners off on their own but still right. pretty happy. You know, confirmed bachelors, confirmed men and women who might be bachelors or bachelorettes, those folks be more in the avoidant right. situation.
So when you have somebody who, like some of these kids we're talking about with this this attachment disorder, what happens if they don't get treatment? What kind of an adult do they become if they don't get any treatment?
Well, it's interesting to speculate that they may become what we consider sociopaths or psychopaths, broadly defined. But they are generally maladaptive in society because they can't really attach to anything. And mm-hmm. when they do attach, it is not a very secure attachment. So if you think about a secure attachment, you know, how do you shake someone's hand? Your hands are attached. If you have a very loose attachment, maybe trying to hang on to something with one finger. Mm. Or if you're hanging from a ledge in the old cartoon, someone mm-hmm. hanging by their fingertips, and they hang by one hand and then a couple of fingers, and the audience goes, ooh, that kind of loose attachment is the type B attachment, the anxious attachment. They have difficulty being able to just get it together. And life and humanity is really about human relationships. If you cannot negotiate successful human relationships, the next best thing is to negotiate relationships with other objects, animals, plants, careers, possessions, anything that helps you have a relationship that's meaningful to you, because that'll help your life go along. Mm-hmm. People who have an anxious attachment, they don't really have any meaningful relationships. And when any kind of semblance of a relationship with anything that they have, specifically, let's say an animal or a garden or a home, something that they're so attached to and is finally taken away from them because the animal dies, and someone tramples on their flowers, or they lose their home to foreclosure, it is actually earth-shaking and mm-hmm. devastating yeah. to these people.
Right.
Whereas another person may think, oh, well, we can try and get over this. Well, for people who have an anxious attachment, quite often there's no getting over it.
Yeah. Yeah, they lack what in the research has been called a secure base, which is the mother, essentially, the figure of the mother always being there, always mm-hmm. being available to go back to mm-hmm. when the going gets rough. And they don't have that internal mm-hmm. sense that exists for them.
Right.
This is why moms got a bad rap in the early years of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy with psychologists and psychiatrists. They said they blamed the mother because the mother was cold and distant, so it created children who were schizophrenic and autistic. And, you know, moms got a bad rap. It was decades before the profession smartened up to realize what was going on.
Right.
And sometimes some people still think moms get a bad rap and have caused all these things, and that's
not the case.
Yes,
yeah.
This attachment system that's part of our brain mm-hmm. is, first off, very elaborate, and it's been evolved over millions of years, and it's very important, and it comes from genes to a large degree. And mothers have a relatively, if you look at the totality, relatively little influence over guiding it. I've heard, and now I don't know how accurate this is, but in terms of the personality development and how children actually turn out, it's been estimated that 50% of the influence comes from genes. 5% comes from parents. The other 45% is something of a mystery. Has a lot to do with just experiences.
Yeah.
And especially peer experiences have a lot to do with how personality develops. And it kind of makes sense when you think of it from an evolutionary standpoint that it should be a large involvement with peers. Because when the child grows up, he's going to have to negotiate his strategies for reproduction and survival, which are the two biological imperatives, with his peer group, mm-hmm. not with his family, right. not with his parents.
Right.
So he needs to learn the rules of the peers more than he needs to learn the rules of his parents, so to speak, in terms of the biological imperative.
That makes a lot of sense, because when you think about, you know, families with large amount of children, and you've got the same set of parents, and the kids can be all completely different.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even with two kids.
Right. We're talking about the psychology of attachments with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abruzzese. Our toll-free number, excuse me, if you'd like to join the conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So can you ever have more than one of these styles in a person?
Yeah, there can be a mixture, and there is a defined mixture of the anxious avoidance style, which is an individual who just kind of fluctuates between the two, or has an amalgam of the two. Those people are pretty disturbed in terms of their relationships. They have very little chance of having something secure. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting in terms of combinations that in terms of mating and selection of partners, the anxious has a propensity to bond with the avoidant, and the avoidant have somewhat of a propensity to bond with the anxious, because in both parties, it reinforces their expectations, their traumatic expectations, because from the avoidant, the anxious appears to be controlling and dominating because they're asking for closeness all the time. And for the anxious, the avoidant appears to be just what they expect, somebody not to be there and to not be connected with them. So I'm sure if there's any couples therapists out there listening to this, they're hearing something familiar.
Yeah.
One partner wants more closeness, wants emotional connection, and the other one wants to solve problems and do work or play golf something obsessive like that.
Well, I think we have to differentiate among the aspects of psychological impact we're talking about here. I think we're mixing temperament with attachment. Attachment simply is the basic ability to form attachments. And you don't want to put too much on that. If you have a basic ability to form attachments, it does not mean that your life is going to be just a bed of roses, because if you have a different temperament, you talk about two or three different children in the family, that's really temperamental issues that are different, not attachment issues. You could have a biological difficulty that makes it difficult to read faces, for example.
Yeah.
You can't read faces. Or if you're born with a learning disability you're born with learning disabilities, one of them could be a nonverbal learning disability, you don't get the nonverbal communication.
Right.
So that certainly could contribute to a person developing an attachment disorder, not necessarily reactive attachment disorder, but because they never had the ability to bond appropriately, not because either mom or dad was not, or brother or sister was not exuding that kind of attachment behavior, but the child had difficulty interpreting it. That's really more of a developmental issue, not really an attachment issue.
Yeah, there's an impairment in the equipment, more or less.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And also, as kids get older, it is true that they try and use what they've learned at home in their peer relationships, and they have to have a good coach, if they can't pick this up on their own, to figure out, okay, that's how I acted at my home. I can't act that way with my peer group. And to behaviorists or cognitive behaviorists like me, I would say that's really a matter of reinforcement and information processing. So you can see how the basic foundation is the ability to have attachments, and that is either consolidated or loosened up by our home life, our early home life, the first 2 or 3 years. And after that, we sort of make it up as we go along, depending on the inputs from the environment. So it's a much more difficult interplay from these various psychological aspects. It would be easy. I wish we could say it was all attachment, just diagnose type A, B, or C.
Yeah. But it's much complex, more complex, as you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting when you talked about the anxious folks having a more difficult time. It makes so much sense because, as Mark, you were saying, do they love me enough? There's all these. It sounds like it's high maintenance. There's a lot going on there.
I think you used it.
Yes, you said psychological effort. I mean, they're using a lot of energy, psychological energy. So, I mean, that is going to, if you're the partner with that person, that certainly is going to mean you're going to be expending a lot of.
Yeah, these are the individuals that text all the time. The other partner,
what Mark.
Are they doing? They call a lot.
Call a lot. Where were you?
They would be the stalkers when the relationship breaks up.
Well, I think for people who are listening, it's important to understand if you have an attachment disorder, and when I mean you broadly. These are people who go to work with you. They're your coworkers. They're your boss. Sometimes you have a terrible boss. Well, it's just bad skills because no one taught them how to be a boss, or do they have an attachment disorder? People who are coworkers, do they have a difficulty attaching to their task?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Are they difficult coworkers? They're probably difficult in everything they do.
Right.
You know, so is someone having a difficult time in a relationship? They probably have a difficult time driving in traffic with other drivers.
That's true.
And this is what Mark has talked about, burning up all the psychological energy. It's enormously difficult and exhausting to deal with that kind of stuff because you never know what's going to happen. You don't have that secure base. You don't have that sense of okayness, that things are going to be okay. This traffic will never end. This day will never end. This boss is never going to, like me and get off my back. This coworker is never going to do their job. It's extremely distressful.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah, but if you have an understanding of what this attachment theory is and what we're saying, it tends to, I think, relieve a little pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it basically normal,
at least easier to understand. Right?
Yeah. Easier to understand, yeah. and just part of living. It's mm-hmm. part of something we all have to contend with.
Right. Yeah.
All right. I want to ask about attractiveness. All right. So, you know, what...
Mindy, beauty is the eye of the beholder.
It truly is. It is.
I think that's because of projection, wouldn't you say?
So what is it that attracts us to a particular person or type of person?
Well, the theory goes that what's attractive is what is in our biological interest. Mm-hmm. So that men are attracted to women that have symmetry, that have features that are conducive to having children. A shapely body with mm-hmm. wide hips, large breasts,
mm-hmm.
All connote fertility. So that is at least a biological basis of what gets elaborated into attractiveness. Women, on the other hand, a little bit different because they need to be attracted to resources because they bear the children for 9 months. Their first and their next 2 or 3 years are taken up with rearing raising the child almost entirely. And they can't reproduce at all during that time. So they have to pair with somebody that is resourceful.
Mm-hmm.
And that resourceful man can be somebody who looks tall, strong, who can go and be a hunter very well. Because this is where our brains evolved, mm-hmm. is when we were hunter-gatherers. Strength and resource-rich. And now in our society, it would be the sugar daddy or mm-hmm. something like that. But,
right. It's evolutionary psychology would certainly agree with what Mark is saying. Evolutionary psychologists, that's pretty much what all the attraction about. So you're going bar hopping and whatever you think is going on, it's probably nothing like that. It's all about biological imperatives. And
right.
that is really what's making the engine go. And as Mark, I think, just about to get into the sociological aspect, our society tends to be totally at odds with what the biological imperative. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that makes more sense than an attractive woman who looks like she's in her fertile childbearing years, looking for resources to take care of her and the family, because that's the biological imperative. Well, you get society saying, no, you got to be the perfect mom, you got to go to work, and mm-hmm. the dad should be doing this, and you know your job shouldn't be doing that, and really plays havoc with the biological imperative. So you really have a big disconnect there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a conflict, a big conflict,
yeah.
The mommy wars. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a big conflict.
I'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we've all heard that saying, opposites attract. Correct. True? Not so true?
Well, it depends on how you define opposites. If you're mm-hmm. if you're a person looking for a if you're a woman looking for a man who can provide for her, I mean, what is that person going to look like? Talk about opposites attract. Wasn't there a song out years ago about pretty women with gorillas? You know, you always, well, why is that beautiful woman out with this ugly troll kind of person over there? Off, clearly, the woman is doing her job. You know, she's taking care of her family. She's found someone who, you know, provides for her, provides mm-hmm. nurturing for her and also resources for her. And the guy is doing his job. He's being able to, you know, provide. The only time that doesn't work out very well is when we think that there's something wrong with that. And we have our friends say, oh, but I never liked that person in the first place. Why are you with that person? That tends to, you know, throw a monkey wrench into mm-hmm. the plan. So people are biologically, they're just trying to get on with their lives and do their jobs and play their roles. And
sure.
as our society mm-hmm. changes, those roles get swift and some switched and some people get confused about them.
Yeah.
Right, right.
So when you're talking about opposites attract, I don't think it's so much opposites attract. I think it's the perception of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these people are so different. When in reality, yeah. these people are doing
might
what they're
same.
Supposed to do. I'm finding resources, you know, and I'm finding someone who could reproduce, have a family, keep
right.
the species going.
Yeah. I always thought that was an odd saying, because if you're opposite, just, you know, you have opposite interests, opposite, you know, how are you going to make that last? You know, you have
yeah.
nothing in common.
Right.
You know,
right.
So,
then you get bored.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
You
yeah.
Say,
so then, I mean, you could see it could starting out as a physical thing, but
right.
then what, you know, then.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
that was when you mentioned what men, you know, are looking for in women. I wish I could remember where I saw this. This was years ago. There was some sort of study. They showed a group of men, 10 women, if it was 10, I might have the number wrong, and rated them, you know, in attractiveness. And then they did the same thing with women, and they had them rate the men in attractiveness, and the men were pretty similar. And you know, when who was the number one, but the women were all over the place, which I found was really interesting.
Well, maybe it could be translated into that resource
right.
Based value versus childbearing appearance.
Well, I think
value.
It may actually go into a perception of resources. So the woman has to perceive someone to being a good. Good provider, good resource, and another woman may not perceive that person the same way.
That's right. Yeah,
exactly. Well, there was an interesting article in Psychology Today that had the biology of attraction, and there was some interesting notes in there. Flirting. Seems women flirt with the same sequence of expressions around the globe. I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's not different. It's the same, no, you know.
It's wiring.
It's just hardwiring the biological imperative that Mark has been talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the we all women around the world, no matter what the culture, have the same nervous system, more or less, that controls the same muscles that are used to communicate the flirt.
Mm-hmm. And then baboons gaze at each other during courtship, and just like humans do. An anthropologist, Barbara Smut, said of a budding baboon courtship, it looked like watching two novices in a singles bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think the research was taken on to in singles bar, where psychologists or series, a bunch of them.
Where predictably they found a number of baboons in there as well.
Exactly. Yeah, baboon-rich environment that was. Yeah. But things like body language, the males in the body in the singles bar would stake out a territory, whether it be a seat or some the jukebox or something to lead on. And from there, they would behave in come-hither moves of thrusting out their chest, exaggerated moves of, say, lighting a cigarette or taking a drink, all sort of promenading their body parts.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the women promenade theirs in a different, in a similar way, but also have this, like you said, similar facial movements and head positions that invite attention. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the eyes. Right. When the eyes connect, that is that's where the romantic love can get started.
Right. Jeff is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Are you there?
Hello, yeah.
Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi. Enjoying your show. I'm just visiting the Cape. I'm at the Wellfleet Audubon Center, and I happen to turn you guys on. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I matriculated at Smith Social Work School at the tender age of 28, 1984, and my head was spinning for 3 years, studying and reading and writing 10 papers a week about human psychology. So I just had a quick, slightly, I suppose, philosophical thought or question as to the kind of intergenerational suffering that occurs lives, and I wonder if the guys could comment on that, and sort of from a philosophical angle, how do you guys think about kind of stopping that? And as a 57-year-old guy, how to, in our 30s, 40s, and 50s, truly find happiness? And I'll close with this. I mean, I mentioned psychology can sound very confusing with all these terms, et cetera, et cetera. But what I guess I'm asking at the heart of it, what are the guys' senses of how an adult finds happiness?
Finds happiness in romance or happiness in general, Jeff?
Happiness in general.
Okay. That's a tough question.
Well, it's a tough question, but it's the question that people always answer, even in childhood. How do I, when you're a very young child, how do I get mom and dad's attention? As you're an older child, how do I get my friend's attention? How do I get my teacher's attention? You know, how do I get these cool-looking kids' attention when I'm in high school and college and all that kind of stuff? So it's a question we always ask ourselves. And part of that is based on the fact that we know that as humans, we know that relationships are really important. So the answer switches as the environment switches. And whenever society goes through a seismic change, as it has, for example, after the world wars and after the financial panics that we've had and people are downsized, all the rules that we learned to get in our head, they're all wrong because they no longer operate in the new world, the new brave world. And it's always been my bias, it's always been seeming that commercialism and marketing in the time after World War II really tends to skew society, so it makes it more difficult for people who are on the edges of society, the very young and the very old, and that is kind of determined between the age of 24 and 54, the kind of premium years for marketers before that and after that. Marketers have always thought that people don't have enough money, so they tend to get marginalized. So we have to make this up as we go along. Individuals have to find their own way of finding something that is meaningful to them. And if you want to use the evolutionary analogy, if there's no more water in the watering hole, where do all those animals go? They have to search for a new watering hole to keep their life going. If they no longer have a food supply, they actually have to move to get a new food supply. Well, we don't do that nowadays. We stay where we are. We don't pick up roots. We don't, you know, strike the tent and go. We stay in our houses, and we go through as much as we can. And maybe this is what Jeff is talking about when he talks about the suffering as people get older. If we're not able to match the environmental change that we have, it creates a great amount of stress within us. We can either approach that stress with a good heart or with an anxious heart. And when we are anxious about things over which we have no control, that creates suffering in individuals. Suffering is a psychological construct that exists in humans. I'm not sure it always exists in animals. Pain exists in animals, but I'm not sure that suffering exists in animals the way it exists in humans. We sort of make ourselves suffer. There are some people who are monks, and you know, they're perfectly happy being alone. They never suffer.
You gave me a wonderful introduction about what I wanted to say right now. Getting back to his question about philosophy and happiness, what I think makes sense is the following. It's a Buddhist principle, and it goes something like this. There are two things in life that are absolutely inevitable and unavoidable. One is, no matter what form of life you are, whether you're going to be a fish or a leaf on a tree or a human or a cat or a dog or whatever, number one is there's going to be changes. That's you can't avoid
that.
Number two is you're not going to like some of the changes. You can't avoid that. So one and two are principles that have to happen. Suffering, however, which is number three, is optional because suffering comes from not accepting one or two. It comes from trying to change, trying to control, trying to rewrite the fact that there are changes and there are unpleasant and negative changes. But if you can develop a sense of acceptance, which is what the monks do in their meditation, then you can have a sense of equanimity and at least absence of suffering. Absence of suffering can be defined as happiness to some degree.
You know, it's interesting they say that because, you know, you grow up and like you're saying, that you know, the TV shows and things like that once upon a time, happily ever after. So you're always thinking happy life. And I had this friend when I was in my 20s who said to me, Mindy, you realize there's no such thing as a happy life. There are only happy moments. And it was like this aha moment. I went, oh my God, it doesn't exist. That That's happily ever after doesn't exist. So there was this like this acceptance
That's
you know, that, okay, there'll be happy moments. And when you're in the bad moment, it comes to that change. Nothing is permanent.
So
when you're in those happy moments, enjoy them because you're going to have some bad ones following. And if you're in a bad moment, it's not going to last forever. The happy moments will come back.
Exactly. And it's interesting, too. Biologically, we're more biased to live in the unhappy and the negative because from survival, that's what made a difference. Happiness, the happy moments are relatively transitory. When it comes to, say, money, if you win money, say, at the casino, you're happy for a little bit. But when you lose, that lasts. And that you felt is much more deeply. You want to reverse it, and that's why you go back again and lose again probably.
Well, I want to speak directly to a question that Jeff had also asked. And, you know, what do you do to sort of mitigate happiness? And the recommendations I give people, they never like. Don't read the newspapers. Don't look at television. Go back to reading all the classic books that people say are classics. Spend a lot of time in nature. He's calling from the wildlife sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And it's great. So you want to spend a lot of time in nature, and you want to invent something that works for you. That's what Henry David Thoreau tried to do all those years ago, and some people think he did a good job and didn't do a good job. But he said something that is really true. He said, things don't change. We change.
Mm-hmm.
So we have it within our power to change. And if I wanted to change how I was reacting to my environment, I would change my environment to exclude most of the things that society thinks is important, which is a lot of visual media, a lot of newspaper stuff, and I would go out and reinvent myself as much as Thoreau did to get more in touch with nature, because if anything touches our evolutionary experience, it is being in touch with nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that helps, Jeff.
The other thing, too, a lot of people now, we've got all the social media, and this is reminding me of this, and there was, I think it was in the New York Times, where it was a teenager who wrote this op-ed piece about how he left Facebook because it made him feel lonely.
Well, it makes you feel horrible. Yeah.
Made him feel lonely, and he felt like he wasn't accomplishing anything. And I mean, what a smart kid to realize that as a teenager, right?
That's right. That's right.
But that's another thing I think that draws people into making them feel more isolated, where, you know, you'd think it would be the opposite, but it's not.
No. Well, again, it's in the service of commercial development. You know, I mean, it's good for Facebook. It's good for the investors in Facebook. And I think when Facebook started, like when the internet started, it was very handy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were able to use it. It was a very manageable tool. Now it is not a manageable tool anymore. It manages them.
Yeah.
The tail is wagging the dog. You've got to be careful.
Yeah. We're talking with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, 866-999-4626. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've got an email from Holly. She says, could you talk about the invisible partner /Sanford? I'm not sure if that's SS type. I'm not sure. A great book for the layperson. Do you know what that is? Partner?
The Invisible Dancer?
The Invisible Partner.
The Invisible Partner. I'm not familiar with that.
And then it says anime versus animus.
Oh, well, if they're talking about anime like the Japanese anime, or if they're talking about the psychoanalytic concept of animus versus anime, I don't know what they're referring, but my guess is they're talking about the psychoanalytic concept. I will defer to Mark on that.
Well, I was going to defer to you because that's one that I didn't get the memo on.
We don't always know the answers
to
everything.
I'll be happy to tackle that because I was originally trained as an analyst in the psychoanalytic theory before behaviorism came along. The psychoanalysts basically thought that all behavior is non-conscious in the respect that it's more procedural, which means we don't have immediate access to it. Yes, that's certainly true. But they had a lot of psychiatric or psychological constructs that they developed from that, the sort of hypothesized on hypotheses to develop. Mm-hmm. And one of them was the aspect of our a native part of us deep inside, like the id, ego, and superego. And if she's talking about that kind of anime, animus, that is what that's relating to. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure. Maybe she can clarify that.
Yeah,
and
maybe give us
a call,
Holly.
Yeah.
All right, Melanie's calling from Brewster. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to mention that there's such huge variety in gender identification and sexuality, that the biological imperative that the doctors are talking about kind of breaks down pretty quickly in the simple terms that they're talking about it in. And I'd just like to hear them speak a little bit about that and talk about the kind of nuanced and various nature of gender and sexuality and how that fits in to the biological model. I bring it up because a lot of people seize on this kind of simplistic biological model as a way to defend, say, anti-gay sentiment and why
good point.
Being gay is in quotes, wrong.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep. No, yeah, Melanie, we've got an email kind of asking the same question you're asking from Patty, so go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great point. I would love to know whether the people in the African savannah engaged in homosexuality. I would willing to bet that they did because of the need, going beyond the need for or associated with the need for procreation and replication of the genes, is the need for security. And if you can get security through an attachment with someone of the same sex, why not? Also, there's the added benefit of having a secure relationship with someone of the same sex in that they're very much like you. They're more like you than someone of the opposite sex. So when you look into their eyes, when you look at their body, you're looking at your own and you get a sense of self-love, which I think has a survival value, not just the simple reproductive value of the more usual pairing. But clearly, the heterosexual pairing has been dominant. Otherwise, we wouldn't all be talking here. Mm-hmm. There definitely is both. And I think if we were to know about the sexual interactions of the people millions of years ago, I think we would have seen homosexual connections.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we just want to remind Melanie, we're talking about the biological imperative for attachment, of being attached to other people.
Right.
That does not know gender. That simply indicates that we really want to be attached.
That's right.
We want to make – these are capacity for affiliations. Certainly we know from some very few studies that have been done in jailhouse sexuality, you don't have a whole lot of mingling of the genders in jailhouse sexuality. But there are some people who clearly engage in behavior for protective reasons, which is very similar to what we talked about earlier, the biological imperative and pairing off. You know, who can I find, who has the resources that will protect me on that? So this, we're just talking about the fact that we have a biological imperative for connectedness with other people, and it does not seem to be biologically limited as much as it is environmentally limited or psychological. Those are psychological manifestations that are different from the biological. So in many respects, who we choose to have behavioral interactions with is quite often a choice. It's not often a choice if we're in an environment that is coercive. But we know that people can change their behavior based on psychological imperatives. And sometimes the psychological imperatives, all things being equal, trump the biological imperative. So we're just talking about the fact that makes it possible for us to engage in certain behaviors. It's not an impetus that we must engage in certain behaviors, only permits us that we may engage in certain behaviors. Does that help address a part of your what you're trying to get to, Melanie?
I would just say that in your statement that you just made, there are so many assumptions in the statement. For instance, that in jail, there's only one gender. We now know that the gender is broad and various among sexes. And the other comment that in a same-sex relationship that you look like your person, if you saw my girlfriend and me, you would laugh. So I just, and I'm not saying this to be argumentative, I'm only pointing out that the science and the understanding of these things is changing quite rapidly, so that all of our assumptions, I think, around this stuff really need to be challenged, and especially in relation to kids coming up mm-hmm. and being able to really ask themselves who they are in a deeper way than maybe we were allowed to when we were younger.
Yeah, good point.
There's good news in that, mm-hmm. that last comment.
Yeah, about kids, yeah. Melanie.
Well, I would still have to say that we're talking about attachment theory, and attachment theory really is gender neutral.
Melanie, thanks. Thanks for the call. Thanks for bringing up the topic.
Very provocative. Yeah. And I don't think you were meaning to say that sexual orientation is a matter of full choice.
No, I'm talking about behavior, not orientation.
Yeah. Right.
No.
Right.
What about love at first sight? What do you guys think about love at first sight?
Well, I think it exists.
Yeah.
You know, I think it exists. And again, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. In psychoanalytic terms, we talk about projection. Mm-hmm. You know, we are attracted to what we are familiar with. We also have idealized visions of the story about Don Quixote, you know, to, what was that song, to each man his Dulcinea. Mm-hmm. You know, so it really has a lot to do with the individual person and what the person is bringing to the table. And there's some old analysts who are always saying that all thinking is projective, all human relationships are projective, and we really are just falling in love with ourselves projected onto someone else who we have somehow tricked ourselves into believing is really just us. So there's a lot of different theories on that, as no one really has a clear theory other than the fact that certainly we are attracted. Even Woody Allen has a theory. He says, you know, you don't really know who you're going to be attracted to, and love is not explainable by rational means.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. No, it's automatic, and that's what makes it exciting and pleasurable. You can just assume that we're all hungry for attachment, and when you see a piece of cheesecake in the form of another person, you go for it. We have that appetite and need to satisfy it. And there's no reason that it shouldn't be love at first sight, because it is the first the first taking in and excitement that gets generated. And when that excitement gets generated by some feature or characteristic or tone of voice or something like that, it usually reminds the individual of some pleasurable relationship in the past in a very special way. Mm-hmm. And that's enough to get the motor going.
Yeah, of course.
Many people think that, what's the saying, love goes in the eyes and it leaves the eyes. It's really more of a visual kind of thing. Certainly that's not true for everyone.
Sure.
But certainly that is the perception of it. You know, if you see someone there very attractive to you, doesn't mean they're very attractive to anyone else, not even attractive by any objective measure, but there's something about them that is attractive to you that goes deep inside to what I will call into your procedural memory, a memory that we don't have immediate verbal access to, that is an association, and that attracts our attention more. Now, that could be greatly enhanced or diminished depending on the future contact with the person. But there's an association with, again, with old analysts used to call a clang association, something that grabs us right away.
Well, and different kinds of love. I mean, there's the romantic love, but there's also the friendship kind of love where, you know, you've met somebody and you're like, wow, they just feel like you've known them forever and there's just something about them, same kind of a thing as an immediate attraction.
Yeah.
And you
sense of security, a sense of togetherness that is pleasurable.
Okay, back to that romantic love. Infatuation fades. You can't be having this, you know, like the beginning of your relationship forever. You'd be exhausted.
That's right.
So that's...
You accommodate.
I mean, right? Or you work at it. You have to work at it anyway.
That's right.
Well, as Mark said, accommodation. I mean, Piaget talked about the basic developmental theories, either assimilation or accommodation. I mean, you get used to things. You learn how to roll with the punches. You get along with things. So I think we'd probably call that a maturation of love. Mm-hmm. You know, love is made up of many variables, and some of them are explainable in verbal terms and some of them are not. Like one of the old, wasn't it John Paul Stevens and one of the Supreme Court justices, I don't know what pornography, I don't know what pornography is, but I know it when I see it.
I
just can't explain it. So there's some things that defy rational explanation, yet we know them somehow, again, by that clang association. It's multi-determinant, and I think there's a really, as love matures, we see that it's really like a diamond, many different facets of love. And there's some people well into their 80s and even in the 90s that still do have a romantic and physical attraction to each other. That's a misnomer to think that people stop.
Sure.
Didn't Miley Cyrus say you stop having sex after 40? I want her to check in with us again in 20 years.
That's right.
See what she says. Way,
yeah, no, love is something else in life that changes.
Yeah.
Characteristics of it change. And the initial infatuation and excitement does diminish or does change, at least.
All right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, as always, thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.